Hello, I'm novelist and critic Kim Newman, and I'm here with...
writer and editor and Hellraiser unit publicist, Stephen Jones.
Yes, unusually for one of our commentary tracks, and as for all three of the films in this box set, you were there from inception to release on all of these films.
Maybe not inception, but you actually know where
all the bodies are buried. And
yeah, well, I think you see most of that in the films as well.
Yeah,
but yeah, I was lucky to be involved with Hellraiser, which was my first actual film I worked on, although I'd been down on sets.
It's Clive Barker's Hellraiser.
Yes.
Absolutely. Whereas, for instance, you never see it listed in the way, I don't know, John Carpenter's Vampires
That's
is
right.
listed. But Clive scored that possessory credit.
And you know, you and I have this conversation all the time. If the possessory credit comes on first and then the title comes on, it doesn't count. But if they're both up there at the same time, it counts.
Yeah.
And I mean, basically, this was Clive's baby from beginning to end. I mean, I got involved because I was actually in Los Angeles doing an interview with John Carpenter, who was finishing up Big Trouble Little China at Fox, 20th Century Fox. And I went there to interview, through our mutual friend Dennis Etchison, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, I got to interview John Carpenter about Big Trouble in Little China. And then we went out for lunch after the interview at the Fox Canteen. And John and I were chatting, and he said, "Steve, have you ever thought of coming out to California and working in the movies?" Because I was directing video commercials and documentaries and stuff in Soho. And I said, no, basically I'd be a very small fish in a very big pond in Hollywood. You know, I just do TV stuff and whatever. And then he said, "Well, with all your writing and everything, have you ever thought about being a unit publicist?" And I went, what are you talking about? And I thought about it, and I came back to London. I phoned Clive up, and I'd known Clive because Ramsey Campbell had introduced us before the Books of Blood had even come out. And I phoned up Clive and I said, "Clive, you're making some little movie in London. Have you got a unit publicist?" And he said, "No, Steve, we can't afford one." I said, "Well, you can now. I'll take 3 months off my job because I co-owned the company and I'll be your unit publicist." And he said, "Well, you have to clear it with my producer, Christopher Figg." So we set up a meeting in the Dover Street Wine Bar in Piccadilly. And I saw Chris Figg and we had a bottle of wine. And I said, "Look, I'll do it for free. I don't mind. I'll do just for the experience. I'd love to do it." And, you know, and I know horror and I know about this stuff because even back then I was into the horror field. And by the end of the bottle of wine, Chris Figg said, "You got the job and we'll pay you. You start, you know, in 3 weeks' time or whatever." And that's how I got the gig. And actually, John Carpenter was right because it took the skills I had as a director, producer on video and the skills I had as a writer and interviewer. And it combined the two into this movie. And as you know, Kim, because I brought you down on set, I also had all the contacts for the horror field. So I was able to bring all my mates in and also a lot of the American people. But the cool thing about what I did on this movie was I treated it like a serious movie. And the problem with most horror films up to that point, even in America as well, is they never treated them as anything serious. So there would be publicity done, but the publicity wouldn't come out until the film came out, which, of course, you've got like a 2-week, 3-week window, and then it's all gone. And I thought, you know what? You and I have always struggled sometimes to get access to the actors or movie stills early and all that kind of stuff. And so I treated it like, from the day one we started shooting, I started bringing people down on the set. I did the EPK, the electronic press kit, where I filmed interviews with people that we could put onto TV shows and put all that stuff out. So I treated it in a very different way. I had T-shirts, I had button badges that said "There are no limits."
I've still got one.
Yeah, I've still got one. I'm probably quite collectible now. And so when the press came down, every week I would update the press notes so that when a journalist came down, there would be quotes, there would be background information, there would be stories. Rather than having to wait 6 months, eight months till the film came out, they had all that.
In fact, I remember I interviewed Clive when you were in pre-production and I was on the set. Apparently I was the only person you would let interview Christopher Figg. I don't know.
Chris was a lovely guy.
I think Chris Figg is the absolute unsung hero of this film.
And the next two films as well, in many ways.
And I think and his subsequent horror credit was Dog Soldiers, which proves that he kept an eye for genre.
Oh no, his career has gone on. I mean, and Chris Figg's career, basically he got taken off through no fault of his own off of Nightbreed. So I think I'm not sure he even gets a credit on Nightbreed. But no, everybody enjoyed working with Chris Figg. And as I say, my drunken evening, we wasn't that drunk, it was only one bottle of wine, but he was so nice to me and he was so trusting of me, and everybody trusted him. And of course the great thing about being a producer is his job is to look after Clive, and this was Clive's first movie. Well, it's his first movie ever, other than some, you know, the little short movies he had made.
Yeah, I mean, he'd made, I suppose, underground films. Or
I guess that's what you'd call them now, what, The Forbidden and things like that.
But they are... it's like they weren't even really finished until after Hellraiser came out, and then they were sort of tidied up a bit and put out on video. Nigel Wingrove at Redemption released them.
And featured Doug Bradley. They featured Peter Atkins, who wrote, you know, the sequels things.
And he'd done a lot of work in the theatre as well.
I think that's what really makes this film, because he, obviously, new film, whatever, but it's the theatre. And everything you see in Hellraiser 1 and Hellraiser 2 to a certain extent, it all comes back to the performances, to the story, to the interaction, the stuff you don't get anymore. I mean, I wouldn't even call them action scenes in this. There are a few scenes where stuff happens. And in fact, it's quite nasty stuff. This is 1986 we shot this, 1987 it came out. And I don't think today they would go as far as some of the scenes in this. It's quite interesting in that respect. But Clive instinctively knew what he was doing.
And there had already been a Clive Barker movie made.
There'd been two, of course.
Two, yeah. Neither of which he was particularly happy with. I remember him saying, well, if that's all they want, I might as well direct the next one myself.
Well, Transformations, I think, was the first one,
Underworld,
wasn't it? An Underworld. Yeah.
Underworld was what it was called.
And then I think we went down, what's the second one?
Rawhead Rex.
It was Underworld. We went to the press.
That's right.
Thing. We went on set and met the director.
Yes,
and
George Pavlou. And actually,
an amazing cast now when you look at it.
I think he was a talented guy. Yeah. Underworld, which is a film that actually was barely released. I don't think it got a theatrical release in Britain. It came out on VHS years later. Objectively, it had a better cast than this.
Well, Denham Elliott was the lead.
Stephen Burkoff.
Yeah, there's all sorts of people in it.
Nicola Calvo from Dream Child. Yeah, it's like, it looked, Larry Lamb, it looked like a really solid picture, but it didn't come together. There were various problems with it.
I think one of the things was the makeup and stuff, which never quite carried off with the mutant creatures. Whereas Rawhead Rex, I think, is very interesting. I mean, Rawhead Rex is kind of like Blood on Satan's Claw, but 10 years later.
Yes. Yeah.
But it is an early example of folk horror, of course, or later, I guess, a mid version of folk horror. And Clive's, it's very true to Clive's story as well. So Clive already had a couple of film credits, but to go in, and, you know, nothing if not ballsy, to go in to New World Pictures, which, of course, had been owned by Roger Corman at one point. Yeah. It was very much in this kind
was
of thing.
Was it Sandy Howard at this point?
Was it? I don't know.
Because there were several. I think it was the last regime at New World Pictures, wasn't it? Although, after Roger Corman left, it had this period. People talk about, Hellraiser. But actually, House was their successful horror franchise, wasn't it?
House was big.
I think theatrically that made more money than this or sorry, but they had a little run of solid sort of mid-list genre pictures in the 80s. I mean,
our contact on this one, our executive, if you want to call him, was Anthony Randall, of course, Tony Randall, who actually went on to become the director of the sequel. And the interesting thing was that, you know, all the rushes from this had to go back to New World, and they would approve or not approve certain scenes. And there are scenes that we had to reshoot in Hellraiser because the Americans didn't understand them or didn't like them. Because the whole film, as you know, Kim, and we've talked about this many times, where is Hellraiser set?
Yes, yeah.
Is it in America? Is it in England? I mean, it's obviously in England because she's now explained that she's come back. He's already explained, they've come back from somewhere and they're back at the old home. Odd why you would have that lovely house in Cricklewood.
Yeah, and there's later a sequence where Ashley Lawrence, playing an American woman, has a conversation with her British boyfriend about their respective... And the British guy says, oh, I'm so stereotypically unemotional, whatever, and he's been dubbed into American.
It means Cricklewood Railway Station.
So it's actually kind of...
Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and it's almost a thing that... And I remember being... I think the decision to change it to being fake set in America had not yet been made.
Well,
when
this
I was
scene
there.
Was originally shot... The scene with Kirstie on the phone to her dad was originally shot in a very nice, upstairs flat somewhere in Cricklewood, probably. She had a nice Victorian iron fireplace behind her, and outside you could see through the window, and a red bus, a double-decker bus goes by, and there's a post box. And the Americans said, there is no way an American student would be living in such a lovely apartment as that, and we don't want to show the bus or the post box because then people will think it was set in England. And we're like, wait, hold on, what? So they had to reshoot all of that again with her on the phone with a blank wall behind. Because one, it was done at the end, so we didn't have any budget left anyway. So we just stuck her up against a blank wall with a phone, and she just does all the dialogue again. But how ridiculous.
But it's also this strange thing. Obviously, the decision was made that this film was not going to be set in Britain. And you look at the precedents. Nobody seemed to mind that The Omen was set in Britain, set in London.
No, and in fact, I think one of the great strengths of this film is it is got this grittiness, this North London look to it, which is kind of funky. All right, do you want to point out? We're not going to see him again much.
Yeah, the most successful person in this film is Oliver Parker, who is playing second moving man, who comes back for the sequel.
Yeah, pretty much the same role.
He later has gone on to be a director.
Here he is.
He directed a version of Dorian Gray a while back, and the remake of Dad's Army.
The Importance of Being Earnest. Johnny English Reborn.
Yeah, and he's sort of like
he's become the archetypal British director to go to.
That's
now.
Right. He's like a solid, respectable bloke. And here he is.
And did you know his brother is Nathaniel Parker, who went on to a reasonable career as well? Yeah. They do kind of look very similar.
They do,
if you look at them. I never realised that at the time.
He is, of course, yeah. And this obviously is the New York... No, it's not. It's Docklands. It's
I honestly don't understand this. And in fact, in the second film, it's even worse. Because, again, it's like there's New York cops, but it's still set in a weird, grungy hospital.
It's one of these things. I have become reconciled to the fact that now there are whatever it is 15 Hellraiser movies and none of them are shot where they're supposed to be set. I think it's something like Hellraiser 9 finally has some scenes set in London, but they shot them in Romania. The world is just not the world.
I mean, here's the house. All right, so here's the house, which is actually, if anybody wants to go and visit it, it's still there. It's number 187 Dollis Hill Lane, I lived two stops on the underground, London Underground, from this. So every morning I'd get up, get on the tube, go two stops, walk up the hill at Dollis Hill, and I'd be on location having a bacon sandwich by 7 o'clock.
Yeah. And it had those nice, I think the stained glass windows were original.
They were all original. Yeah, Everything you're seeing here.
They didn't actually...
But it's a real house, so there's no breakaway walls, there's no breakaway ceiling. We had to shoot around that staircase because that's a real staircase.
Yeah.
The way Clive pitched this to New World was it's three people in a haunted house.
Yeah.
And that's, they went, that's going to be cheap. And
you mean like House?
Yeah. Like House, which I think that's pretty much the same thing in an American way. But, of course, you're looking at that shot there. The whole crew, 40-odd people, are the other side of the camera, squeezed into that little hallway there.
Yeah, I remember you had to do the interviews in the garden.
Yeah, we had to do the interviews outside, wherever you could go, or the crew bus where you had lunch. Mm. We did a lot of interviews on that because there was no room. It was very difficult. So when you look at it back now and you think, wow, that's a lovely shot of her in the kitchen. That's not a set. That's a real kitchen shooting through the window of the kitchen of her... in a real kitchen. The only scenes that were actually properly shot in a studio were the attic room, which we'll see later, and the landing at the top of the stairs, because there's a lot of action going on in both of those. Again, this is a real house and a flashback and whatever. Though I have to say, I think Claire Higgins here looks stunning. I think that shot of Claire Higgins where she's, I guess, still innocent at this point. I think she looks amazing in this. And again, theatrical background. You can tell. You can tell. And Sean Chapman here as well. Yeah. I always like. He's Royal Shakespeare Company guy.
Neither of them were... this wasn't quite their first film, but it was the first sort of significant work for them.
Yeah.
And they've both gone on to... it's interesting. You look at the cast of Hellraiser, and there are some people who went on to long careers in the theatre and film and television. Of what you actually, Claire Higgins was a star. She won the Evening Standard Best Actress Award for a couple of theatrical
productions.
She won
three Olivier Awards.
Yeah, she's done a whole bunch of work, but not sort of an internationally recognised name. And there are people who've gone on to do Hellraiser sequels and Hellraiser conventions in
their subsequent interestingly careers. Claire Higgins hasn't done that. She was actually due to attend a big Hellraiser reunion in Las Vegas the year we're recording this commentary, and she pulled out the last minute. I don't know why.
She probably got a better gig
at the theatre. Yeah, but she's now known for she appeared in Doctor Who. She was in Sandman. She was a regular on The Worst Witch, which is a children's series based. She was Miss Cackle, and I think she was very good as Miss Cackle. But I think the interesting thing about Hellraiser, and to a certain extent Hellraiser 2, is she's meant to be our protagonist. She's our through protagonist in both movies. Yeah. The Cenobites were just like a little cameo over here. Frank is not even the lead character.
The Cenobites are as important to Hellraiser as Dracula's brides are to Dracula.
And that's pretty much how they were at that point. Yeah, it's a very good analogy.
And yet, subsequently, because Doug Bradley's character is on the poster...
Although he wasn't originally.
And they were the visual interest. They have come to dominate the franchise. If not, actually, many of the later films also don't use them that much. But
they still use Pinhead.
They seem to be the dominant mode of the face of Hellraiser.
She was always intended to be the face, as it were, if you use the expression, of Hellraisers. Yeah. And, I mean, obviously nobody saw it going on to become this ludicrous franchise. In the years to come.
Have you even seen all the Hellraiser
films? I don't know.
Films?
I've certainly seen most of them, and there are some which are better than others, I've got to say. But as you know, and we'll get onto as we go through the three films, a lot of them are not even Hellraiser films. They're scripts for other movies which they rewrote and just stuck the Cenobites or whatever into them, which I think is a bit sad, to be honest with you, because I think it cheapens... It cheapens this film and the other two films. I think of these films, I'm going to say it's quite a lot of times. I think of this as Frankenstein. I think of Hellraiser 2 as Bride of Frankenstein. I think of Hellraiser 3 as Son of Frankenstein. There is an argument to be said that the very flawed Hellraiser 4 could be Ghost of Frankenstein. Yeah. After that, you're into the House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, and all those kind of things.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that hasn't happened, they haven't had Hellraiser meets Wishmaster. Yet. They haven't done...
or Nightbreed.
You think Pete Atkins is out there working?
Hellraiser
has met Nightbreed in comics.
And remember, Clive wrote a novel where his detective character, Harry Damore from Lord of Illusions, meets Pinhead.
And that
was supposedly being optioned several times. So I'm afraid those crossovers are there.
But that's all within Clive Barker's fictional universe. I think you're allowed that. Haven't done, as I say, Wishmaster meets Hellraiser, or Hellraiser meets Mirror Mirror, or Chucky meets
Pinhead,
Hellraiser.
Which is a good thing.
They've done, like Jason meets Freddy, or indeed the classic Anaconda meets Lake Placid, which I'm a great fan of.
Which I'm a great fan of as well, I have to say,
Partly just because I really admire the screenwriter who can watch nine completely different movies and take elements of all of them and weave them together.
Well, I think one of the problems with the Hellraiser franchise, and it has been, is it's different companies making the different films. Although the first two films were New World, of course, then New World imploded and was sold off at a fire sale. And so the rights got sold to another company, and then that company imploded and got sold to another company. Miramax owned them for a while, and we'll talk about that on some of the sequels. I don't think, it's not like you've got the one company running through all of them. And I think that's one of the reasons. And of course, only the first three, I think, in this country ever went theatrical, and then they all went direct to video after that. Yeah. I'm not sure if four went theatrical in America.
Strangely, some of them, even though it's notionally a British franchise, either weren't released here or weren't released here for like 10 years.
Oh, really? Okay, on video.
Whereas we got all the Anaconda films, you know, I mean, films that frankly we didn't want, they all turned up. But some of the, Hellraiser fans had to like import American DVDs in order to keep up.
Maybe that's how I saw some of these. Actually,
to keep up, particularly with the one with Lance Henriksen, and
which is actually one of the better ones.
The one with Henry Cavill.
But this is Hellbound Heart, which of course is the title of Clive's original story that this was based on.
Yeah, do you want to go back and talk about it? Because it was Night Visions, that was the...
It was a novella. It was written as part of the old Night Visions series of anthologies where three authors would have three stories in each one.
Yeah, I did one of those.
And I think Clive only had the one because it was a novella rather than a short story. So it's just the Hellbound Heart.
When that gig was offered to me, I did the same thing.
Because I think Lisa Tuttle was in that one, and somebody else is in it as well.
I think George R. R. Martin...
He's in one, but it's not the same one.
It's
the one he edited.
Yeah, it's the weird thing where one of the authors in the one volume edits the next volume. Although I don't know how much actual editing the editor...
Well, I think, as I was saying earlier, one of the great things about this is Clive goes to America, he pitches it to New World, very simple pitch, keeps the budget down. So for a start, this film is made for $1 million. Not the $3 million that New World claimed it was made after they saw it and ready for release. It was made for $1 million. Even back in 1986, 1987 was not a lot of money for a film, especially a film that looks this good, to be honest.
And I believe that... Was this particular sequence may even been part of the reshoots?
This was the reshoots. This was not part of the original sequence because originally Frank came out the wall. There was Clive was in a wall like the Black Cat, Edgar Allan Poe, and the wolf, and he comes out of that. And again, this is an example where once the film was edited and the Americans saw it, they said no, we need something bigger at the beginning of the film in the first 20 minutes, like a big scene to get the audience going.
I remember talking to somebody in the industry who had only seen the version before the reshoots, and she said to me, oh, it was like a Hammer House of Horror episode. Yeah, it had good stuff in it.
It was a stick puppet, honestly. And it looked like because we were on a low budget. And so they got extra money. I actually wasn't involved in this part of the shoot, although I did go down for one day and visit everybody and see what they were doing because I needed to for the press notes. But this was all shot, I think, a couple of months later. Mm. A little studio down by the River Thames in London. And specifically to give this beat this early in the film, and also to establish, you know, the sheer yuckiness of this movie, because there's a lot of yuckiness in this.
Is there an argument to say that these scenes are co-directed by Bob Keane?
Oh, I think most of the time, I mean, most of the special effects stuff, Bob went on to become a director in many ways. And he also worked on some of the Hellraisers as a second unit director. Mm. He also worked as a special effects unit director. Definitely he would have planned out every single shot. Isn't Niall Buggy who plays the title role
in Zardoz?
Yeah, the famous Irish actor, who's actually just round to take. I guess he must have just known one of the people involved from the theatrical background.
Yeah, I mean, it's
odd to see him in this, and it's a nothing role. He has a couple of lines of dialogue, and then he's gone. But Mr. Zardoz in this.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's kind of interesting that, I think of this, and the way I've always described this film is basically Harold Pinter meets Dante. Mm. It's got a bit of both. You know, it's a bit of kitchen sink drama, British gritty. I mean, it's not Hammer. We're a long way from Hammer now. Hammer finished, mid-70s, let's say. Mm. And when I got involved in this, I was very excited to be involved in this because I thought, we're going to do what Hammer did. In the 80s, we're going to do what Hammer did in the 60s and 70s. We're going to bring horror films back to the British film industry.
Yeah, I was like,
Dream Demon is another good example.
Yeah, that
came
a bit like, what happened was that Hammer films sort of petered out in the mid-70s. I think their last horror film is Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires in 73, 74.
Well, it's The Devil's Daughter as well.
Devil's Daughter, but that's a German co-production.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
And then Pete Walker and Norman J. Warren made films in the mid-70s.
Yes, and into the early 80s as
well. But by the early 80s, I think in Seminoid in 1980, I think Extro in 1983.
Which I went down on set with.
Yeah, after that, there wasn't a British-made, theatrically released horror film until Hellraiser.
There were things
like Life Force, which was shot here.
House of Long Shadows, which I think is the last film, and that is Pete Walker again and those guys. I think that's the last film in that nail, basically. Yeah. And it's great because it's got Christopher Lee, Vincent Price, John Carradine, and
there was a period like between 1983 and 1986, there weren't British horror films. There were, because there was stuff that came out.
Yeah, there's
on
the odd
video,
one here and there.
But there were not theatrically released British horror films. And that's and I've got to say, having lived through it, it seemed like a long time then, those 3 years.
And this is why this was all so exciting to me. The fact that most of the people involved in this went off and lived in America afterwards, and it all kind of fizzled out again.
An American film halfway through. And I think that may be why it was sort of a missed opportunity. You're right, Dream Demon was made probably off the back of the success of this.
Yeah, there was a few. And again, Palace, Vestron, all those kind of guys from that period. They were kind of investing in some of these films.
Yeah, because Ken Russell made Lair of the White Worm.
Yeah, that's another good one
Palace
around this time.
Palace had made Company of Wolves a bit earlier, which isn't really...
It's not really within this,
There was it was that period when the British film industry was fundamentally, it was making Merchant Ivory period pieces and those film on four My Beautiful Laundrette type social realism movies.
Bend it like Beckham type things.
Yeah,
those
but there wasn't that much genre material. There weren't many crime movies. There weren't even... many rom-coms or domestic British comedies, and there certainly weren't horror films. So this was flying
flag. The whole point was that Clive had revolutionised the genre in the mid-80s when he brought out the first three books of Blood, collections of short stories. Certainly, I'd never read anything like it. Clive had never... Ramsay Campbell had never read anything like it. You probably never read anything like it. He really did push the boundaries. And so obviously it made sense that when it came to his first movie... You know, nobody ever seen a skinned man talking on a British horror movie before. And so he really pushed the envelope on this movie.
I remember the slogan was, "There are no limits."
Yeah, that was me, unfortunately.
That was on all the press.
Yeah, and it never went to the final. I think on the final poster, the American said, "It will tear your soul apart."
Yeah, remember there was a thing where after all... at some point, obviously, even if you're Clive Barker, compromises have to be made. And it became, "There are no limits, but I'm taking five shots out of this sex scene in order to get a certificate from the BBFC. And that became...
To be fair, they did not cut this film very much at all. It's literally a few seconds cut. And I think another reason for that, if I remember this correctly, I may be wrong, but this was because Chris Figg... Was it still Trevelyan then, or was it one of those guys?
No,
had he gone?
It was James Furman.
James Furman, sorry. Yeah. But I think Chris Figg actually knew James Furman. I mean, they probably went to the same club or something.
Yeah, that was how the industry went. I mean, I met James Furman a couple of times. Unlike almost anybody else who had that job, James Furman had been a director.
And
he
liked horror movies.
TV stuff, yeah. And
he had respect for them.
Yeah, and what it was, the thing with James Furman is you could say, this is a horror film, but also it has merit.
Yeah.
And he would say, we don't want to blunt the effectiveness. I mean, obviously the BBFC were caught in the middle of the video nasties kerfuffle at the time. Well, and even this sort of, I remember falling into...
It never actually got banned or anything.
But there was a certain amount of...
I'm sure it came up in Mary Whitehouse's complaints.
And I suspect one of the reasons why there are so few British horror films in the 80s was because it was during that period when the tabloids were running the ban this sick filth, shut down all these video shops headlines.
The tabloids, as far as I know, didn't go after Hellraiser at the time because it was something we were very aware of on this and Hellraiser 2. And, you know, when we get to the killings a little bit later on, it really does push...
And
it's like up there with Peeping Tom.
And particularly Hellraiser 2. I was sort of actually... are nastier than most of the films that were listed on the nasties yes. list. But they were sort of, because they were, and that's a British train, I'm sorry, because they were amazing, it's
Cricklewood Railway Station, Cricklewood yes. Lane.
Yeah.
And this is the scene you're talking about where in yes. the original dialogue, she is making fun of his funny accent, his yeah. English accent. But yeah. of course, now they're both dubbed into American.
Means nothing.
It
yeah.
means nothing. And this is the tramp guy who turns yeah. up in at least the first three movies, the yeah, derelict.
I think he's turned up in some of the subsequent ones, although not the same
character.
The character,
he's never the same actor. Yeah. We're pointing that out. Yeah, the derelict. He's actually, the guy who played him, Frank Baker, is actually our friend Steve Gallagher's Chimera as well, the miniseries.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I'd say, we should talk about it because we're not going to be talking much about it. Robert Hines strikes me as being, as it were, the luckless guy in this. He's the guy. He disappears between the films and nobody ever seems to miss
him. He comes back for the ending and Kirstie has to save him. So that yeah. shows you what an ineffectual hero he is.
So he's supposed to be the lead. But I think that dubbing his performance has really hurt him.
I think it hurts a lot of the actors in this. And I think the same is true. Well, I think the same yeah. is true with Sean Chapman as well.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
it really hurts his performance because like Doug Bradley, Sean Chapman's got a really good acting
yeah.
voice.
I remember a little after this, it appears with Kenneth Cranham in a TV play called The Black and Blue Lamp, which is a sort of metafiction about police dramas. And he plays Dirk Bogarde's character from The Blue Lamp. And he does a great Dirk Bogarde in the 1950s wide boy voice. And because basically the premise of Hellraiser is that Frank is so sexy that women will murder people for him. And it's good casting. Sean Chapman has a great sexy bloke voice.
Oh, yeah.
Whoever dubbed him. Does not.
Does not. Exactly. Yeah. It's very flat, actually, as yeah. a dubbing thing, which I think is so sad. But yeah, getting back to Robert Hines, who plays Steve, who apparently is no longer with us,
it turns out. He died quite young.
Died yeah. at age, around about 57 of basically a heart attack. But his career, as you said, I mean, he had, like, he was a crew man in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yeah, yeah. And he's corpse in the van in Point of No Return.
That's
yeah.
not really a career, yeah. is it, sadly? And you know what? He was a great guy, a nice guy on set. I never had any... I mean, I've worked on a lot of films where I've had a lot of problems with people
yeah.
over the years. Sometimes people you wouldn't expect, sometimes the stars of movies have not yeah. been the most pleasant of people. I can't think of anybody on this film who I had dealings with. And of course, my job as a unit publicist is I have to work between the crew, the production people, the studio, in this case, New World. So I have to talk to everybody and interview everybody. Mm-hmm. And as you know, Kim, sometimes interviewing a person on a film set can be quite distracting if they're setting up a scene or whatever. Mm. Clive Barker, as you know also, could not have been nicer. He would make time for everybody. While you say, well, you go on with setting that scene up and I'll go and talk to these people that Steve's bringing on the set. Mm. And the same with the actors, the same with the production crew. People could not be nicer.
Yeah. I'd say the day I remember on set, I'll point out the bit.
Even I don't remember what got you down now.
It was the day that Andy Robinson was watching a boxing match on television.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's pretty weird, that scene. Yeah, okay.
But I remember everybody took time out to chat, and they were all enthusiastic about it. They all knew that there was something exciting and interesting.
I think so.
And
I
even like people, say, like Claire Higgins, whose background was not in stuff like this, knew that this was worth doing.
Well, it showcases her particularly well, I think, in this. Yeah. And also, I mean, you know, you just mentioned here, Andy Robinson.
Who was an odd choice for it.
He is odd. And of course, the only thing we all knew him from at that point was Dirty Harry, for being the psychotic killer in Dirty Harry. Yeah. And he certainly, and except for the end of this film, where he actually goes psychotic again.
That's right.
That's also because he's not playing the same character, really.
Yeah.
But he brings a very straight, downplayed role, character role to this, and I think does really, really good. I think he could not have been nicer. Yeah. Honestly, you know, I talk about some of the actors I've worked with over the years. Andy Robinson is still one of those people I remember as he could not do enough around the crew. For me, certainly helping me with publicity and promotion. He was terrific. He was a really terrific actor. There was no ego, nothing.
But he was still kind of an odd choice. If you were New World, you would have thought, if you want an American in this, you want a name American.
Well, also somebody contemporary. Dirty Harry is 71.
Yeah.
I mean, 86.
And I've got to say, everybody remembered that part from Dirty Harry. He was probably fed up with. I know, in fact, that Don Siegel, who directed Dirty Harry, gave him a really good role in Charlie Varick afterwards. He said, look, I know I've ruined your career. You know, it's like, but here.
Well, again, he went on to Star Trek Deep Space Nine, because he played Garak, didn't he? Yeah, you know, the alien guy from 1993 to 1999.
Yeah. And here's a reminder that this film was indeed made in the 1980s.
You know what? I just thought the padded shoulders, the sunglasses.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you notice, with all three of these first Hellraisers, everybody smokes in every scene. Yes. There's people smoking. Yeah. Which, of course, you wouldn't see now. No, but no. I was quite impressed with the earrings in this scene.
Yes.
Star earrings.
Yeah.
This guy, I thought, was great.
Yeah.
This guy's called Anthony Allen.
Yeah.
I've never seen him. He basically didn't do anything other again. Mm-hmm. But it's quite interesting because the first two victims are these kind of city-wide boys in Hellraiser. The third victim, as it turns out, is not quite the same way. But yeah this guy...
He's in Slade in Flame, which is a cult movie.
Is it? Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he's in a terrific British TV series called Law and Order, not to be confused with the American
one. Yeah, it's basically the British version.
And Between the Lines, he's in that, and
he's obviously playing the same guy.
He's
in all
done
these
stuff
shows,
like The Bill and Casualty, and solid British drama. One episode of Between the Lines was shot in the building we're recording this in.
Well, there you are. But what I think is great about this scene is you're on her side with this. You think this guy is so totally unpleasant. Yeah. You got a hammer, got a claw hammer. Yeah, hit him over the head with it. He's just horrible in this. And it's a great performance by him.
Yeah, and I think that there is... It's not just the clothes and the decor that's 80s. It's the attitudes, isn't it?
His is certainly... You expect him to have one of these giant phones, you know, he's always talking into.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a kind of gay equivalent of homophobia, but the depiction of heterosexual relationships in this film as all completely unhealthy is...
Well, I just thought, also Claire Higgins actually acts so repugnant to this guy's advances.
Yeah.
I mean, she is just so horrible. And it's look at that shot there, that deep focus shot that, you know, Robin Vigen, our cinematographer, did. You know, that was a really nice shot where she actually walked into focus as he went out of focus.
Yeah.
You got to plan that kind
of
stuff.
Do you want to talk a bit about what Robin Vigen brought to this?
I think Robin Vigen brought a lot because I think one of the clever things that Clive did, and so I think, again, this is Chris Figg, the producer, is we were surrounded by people who were veterans of film and television making. So although it was Clive's first film as a director, my first film was a unit publicist or whatever, we were working with people like Robin Vigen, who was the cinematographer, Richard Dicky Marden, who was a film editor. These guys had, you know, tons of credits. They knew what they were doing. The clapper men, the loader men, the lighting rig guys. All these guys were veterans. Yeah. They knew what they were doing.
Robin Vigen has started out as like clapper loader on Hell Drivers and Doctor at Large.
Yes, he had a huge
carry-on
career.
Nurse, carry-on teacher, the Hellfire Club.
But also Circus of Horrors, my friend. Circus of Horrors, Three Words of Gulliver.
But he had worked his way up to focus puller on Dance of the Vampires, camera assistant on The Lion in Winter.
Yeah.
Your bigger films, the final program focus, The Great Gatsby, Jack Clayton's movie, Rollerball.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Star.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at some point, he sort of graduates to becoming a cinematographer in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
And
that's like how the film industry is meant to
but
work.
But this is his first sort of memorable gig as director of photography. I mean, obviously, as a budgetary thing, he'd previously worked just on Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and Never Say Never Again, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Dogs of War, The Lady Vanishes, Hammer's final film. But as, you know, a camera operator or a focus puller, rather than director of photography, this is the first film that lets him show.
And this is his calling card.
Yeah.
I mean, but this is how the film industry is supposed to work. You start out, you know, as a clapper loader, and then you become a focus puller, and then you become a second AD or whatever, or you know, a second assistant photographer, and you work around. And of course, you know, Robin went on. He did The Fly 2, Nightbreed, Highway to Hell, Neverending Story 3. I think one of the Tales of the Crypt episodes. So, you know, he had a very good career, but he knew exactly how this was meant to look. And that, by the way, guys, was the uncut scene. Originally, that was trimmed a little bit when the film first came out. But when it went to video, they put the few seconds back in that were there. Mm. No, they didn't put it back in when they were there. But, I mean, it eventually came out, you know, that kind of thing. But that it's all, I think, the BBFC ever trimmed in this film. So, you know, and again, it was like, you know, I think we laugh about these things. A number of buttock thrusts you're allowed to have
sex.
Yeah,
I remember Clive... having lengthy arguments. I think it was six buttock thrusts he wanted, and they wanted three.
Yeah, I think
buttock
three
thrusts.
Is the maximum you're allowed to have.
Three was allowed.
Yeah. And apparently, I think you're only allowed to have two hammer blows to the head, not three again. Yeah. You know, there are certain rules that somebody somewhere had made up, and you had to do.
And the trouble is, as soon as you codify things like that in terms of rules, it becomes ridiculous.
Of course it does.
And obviously, you can have a hammer blow to a head in a slapstick comedy, and you have 15 of them, and it's funny in the Three Stooges.
But to be honest, now you see that kind of stuff on TV all the time, don't you? People being hit with hammers or chainsaws or whatever. But back then, it was kind of... It was extreme. And I can remember, you know, you and I went to the press screening of this from Entertainment Films, and the press were like, holy... I think people walked out, actually, of the press screening of this, you know, when Entertainment showed it. Well, I think we stayed for the red wine and the sandwiches.
Yeah, so we saw it at BAFTA, actually.
Oh, did we see it at BAFTA? Oh, yes, right. Yeah. It was BAFTA. Was the first time we saw it. I think that was a crew screening I got you into.
Yes, that's right,
And then I think we went to see Entertainment in one of those little cinemas in Soho.
And our own Claire Higgins turned up to that. And I think she walked out of it. But
then again, you get, you know, you go from that scene to this kind of scene. This is why I say, you know, this is what Harold Pinter stuff, where it's like acting. It's people acting on the screen. And you know, here, I mean, of course, it's not Sean Chapman under the thing. No. It's a guy called Oliver Smith, who actually comes back in the sequel as this character and a different character. But the reason he plays the role, and Oliver was, again, a lovely guy, was, you know, he was basically a sort of standing guy or whatever, is he was incredibly thin. So they could get him into the image animation, the special effects people, could get him into that sort of skin costume.
You'll love this. His other major role was as Saul in Jesus of Nazareth, the Robert Powell miniseries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, he's also in, I think he's in Tale of a Vampire, and he was also in, like everybody else, in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But what is nice was when we get to do
he did the bill too, which is like,
they all do
if you're a British actor, you're on the bill at some point.
But you do actually get to see him as himself in Hellraiser 2, which I think is a good thing. Mm. But again, this is a real staircase in a real house, and we had to, and that's real windows, they all like that. So again, Robin had to work with the light he had, the natural light there. You know, and when you're shooting in a bathroom like that, the camera literally has to be stuck in the furthest corner you can get to just to get the angle. Otherwise, you wouldn't even get the angle. And again, I think what is nice about this is basically Julia's journey. She starts off hesitant. She starts off repulsed by what she's having to do to bring her lover back. And by the time the film ends, she's kind of into it.
Yeah. Do you think that if they hadn't wanted an American star, she would have got top billing?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, if this had been a British film, and I think this has been a wholly British film, I think she would have got top billing anyway.
I don't remember her complaining or being upset that she didn't.
Well, again, you see, everybody signs a contract, and so they know pretty much what their billing is going to be on the contract. I mean, obviously, they not only brought Andy Robertson over, but they also brought Ashley Lawrence over to play Kirsty, and this is really her first big role.
Yeah,
and she's not as good in this as she is actually in the next one, where she.
It's one of those things. I actually, watching this again, I'm warming up a lot to Ashley Lawrence.
Oh, very much so.
I think she's terrific in it. But
She gets better because, you know, she goes on to do things like Warlock 3, which she's very good in.
But I know that Clive turned down Jennifer Tilly for the part.
Well, supposedly. I wasn't involved at that point.
I can imagine like three heterosexual producers banging their heads against the wall when being told that. But the thing is, if Jennifer Tilly had played the role, it would have been much more a battle between two strong, sexy, strange women. Whereas Ashley Lawrence is your blonde girl next door.
Well, your dark-haired girl in this one. Yeah. But no, she's very good. And, you know, and she not only goes on to do the next two Hellraisers, but she's also in Hellraiser Heatseeker.
That's right, she came back.
Hellseeker, which I think is the one with Lance Henriksen you were talking about.
No, I think it's the Carnival of Souls one.
Number six. It's number 2006, even 2002.
We get them confused. Oh. Yeah.
But now, of course, she's a very good artist. I mean, she went on to become, I mean, she still acts now and again. But I've got to say, I think Kirsty Cotton is one of the most iconic heroines in modern horror. This is just a great thing, which I think was just improvised on the day. Mm. And it becomes a recurring image in certainly in Hellbound Hellraiser 2. Yeah. It becomes a recurring image. I was actually in this pet shop in, I think it was in Cricklewood when we shot this. There's the angry woman, who was a lady called Pamela Sholto, who was actually in the L-shaped room in 1962. So a little cameo from an old English actress.
I get the impression that sometimes Clive would cast actors because he wanted to hear their anecdotes.
Or Chris Figg would know them from family things.
Yeah.
And this is just a weird scene. But one of the things I had to do as a publicist was always find an image that we could use to sell the film to the press. So in this scene, in between shots, I got Clive to put a python round his neck and pose with it for a photo shoot. And I look back on it now and think, health and safety. The director's got a python wrapped around his neck.
I would have loved to hear you explain to Chris Figg that a python had eaten his director.
Eaten his director. Yeah. It's like, what was I thinking in 1986, nobody cared. It was like, oh, look, it's a python tank. Hey, Clive, pick this up and put it around your neck while we get some photos of you.
Yeah.
And I had a great guy, a photographer called Tom Collins, who worked with me on this, who had a huge number of credits and whatever, knew exactly what he was doing. And he was like up for anything. He would do anything for these photos. But again, a real pet shop, real animals. We just closed it for the day and shot in the pet shop and outside the pet shop. Because you couldn't afford to build this and hire the animals and things. As the films go on, the budget does get a little bit higher. So here's our second victim, who seems very similar to the first victim.
Yeah.
Another wide boy.
She has a thing about male pattern baldness.
Yeah.
Either she really likes it or she really doesn't like it.
Or perhaps everybody in London in 1986 looked like this
had
kid.
That haircut.
Had that haircut.
Right, yeah.
This is a guy called Leon Davis, who, again, I couldn't find anything that he really went on to. I mean, he's not in this very much, to be honest, this one.
The role of second victim.
He's, but...
Oh, he was in, he was in Doctor Who, but he appeared in Christine Edzard's films, Little Dorrit and The Fool. And she had a kind of rep company who worked around her studio. So he was probably one of those.
I love Claire Higgins' backcombed hair in this. Yeah. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
I've got to say, it's starting to look quite a lot more like the sort of hairdo you'd see in a John Waters film, isn't it?
I was thinking some of those music films of the 80s.
But my feeling is, again, because I was sort of there at the time, it didn't strike me as being unusual.
But now you look back at things like Breaking Glass and think, those people look weird, don't they, in Breaking Glass? And all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But, back at the time, it was absolutely natural for her to look like that.
Yeah.
And whatever. But as I say, you'll notice in the Hellraiser films, everybody smokes.
Yeah.
And kids, if you smoke, you'll end up looking like Franklin. Don't do it. Just say no. And again, I think it's kind of nice, and here we get, this is the first time we see we really start to understand the lament configuration box, which actually is not the portal to hell that we think it is. It's a portal. It is a portal to hell, but it's actually a way of doing deals. It's really Aladdin's lamp. It's a way of letting the genie out the box. And these genies are the Cenobites.
Yeah, and that was actually the first shots we really had where we could see
them. What are we in now? We're like 40-odd minutes into the film.
We are past the halfway point.
This is because none of us, and I happily put my hand up, and I think Clive would as well, none of us had any idea that these films would become about the Cenobites and about Pinhead.
Yeah.
They were cool, and they were things that definitely came out of Clive's imagination, and I saw the sketches he had done, and Bob Keane made them real. But they were like, they worked for a few days on the film, mostly on the sound stages, of course, and that was it. And then they were off, they were gone, and it was like, bye, love to see you, love to meet you, Doug Bradley, and all your other people, and that was it. Back to Frank and Julia again.
Yeah, I could
it was
be wrong.
Weird.
I get the impression that Oliver Parker had the choice between playing a Cenobite and shifting
Doug Bradley had the choice.
Oh, right.
And he went, oh, you know what? Yeah, it's going to involve a lot of makeup, but it seems like a more interesting role. I'll play this pinhead guy for a couple of days or something. It's a bit used to
you. So
you came down on this day,
on set
did you?
This day, yeah.
Yeah, he's like, you can tell there's some marital problems going on in this scene. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's not one of the greatest days. This is the set. So this was the set we built at the production village in Cricklewood, which was literally, again, a 10-minute, 15-minute walk away up in the attic. But thank God, because I was, you know, being a horror fan, I was like really impressed with all the Cenobite guys. So I took a lot of photos. You know, I like went nuts when they were on set, because the makeups took 5 or 6 hours to do.
But there was also none of that, oh, we want to, you know, conceal what the monsters look like for the film.
No.
It's like, this is all we've got to advertise the film. It's like, lovely as Claire Higgins holding a hammer is, we don't want her on the poster.
And I think that was one of the original concepts, and Skinned Frank, I think, was. And then somebody, again, way above my pay grade and later on, I think it's a different shoot. Yeah. I think it was shot specially for the poster with Pinhead holding the box.
I'm just off screen in this sequence. I remember
waiting down below the staircase. And that's like all of us. Everybody's just off screen. Clive is just off screen. Because there was no room. I mean, that scene earlier with all the feathers coming down, which Clive really wanted to do, nobody quite understood why it was done. It was
I think he'd probably seen a few too many Tony Scott films.
But honestly, I suffer from asthma.
Yeah.
And I'm in a little room with the entire crew, and that whole room is full of feathers. What do you think happens? People start sniffing and coughing and sneezing and whatever. It was like,
Yeah, that probably didn't happen on Tony Scott's sets, but, you know, it was an 80s thing. And actually, I've seen some people sort of tag the various 80s elements of this.
Oh, okay.
But it doesn't strike me as being a particular... I don't know if Clive watched MTV that much, so he doesn't have that music video feel Russell Mulcahy's films have.
I mean, I think MTV really started to come into its own in the beginning of the 90s, when it started to go out to the Eastern European countries, because I did some movies out in Eastern Europe afterwards. And that's when it started to really make an impression worldwide. As I say, this is very much in the British kitchen sink drama, except it just involves monsters from hell and people coming back from the dead. And you know what I like about this film also? I mean, although you've got Kirsty and Steve as the nominal hero and heroine, it's an adult film. It's a film with grown-ups in it and adults.
I think...
And the relationships are
a couple of the... Well, many of the subsequent Hellraiser films have had teenage protagonists.
Yes, absolutely. They're aimed at that audience.
The film called Hellraiser that came out in 2022 was about kids.
That's the Hulu, the TV one.
Yeah, the one that's kind of annoying because it's just called Hellraiser, so you're now going to forever have to call it Hellraiser brackets 2022.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the same with the Scream. It's three Screams now,
yes,
isn't it?
That's right, and Candyman as well.
Yeah, Candyman.
It's like, no, at least, yeah, give it a different name so those of us who have to...
And what's annoying, I can understand if it's a remake...
Yeah.
You might want to call it the same thing again. But if it's a sort of semi-sequel or semi-reboot or those kind of things...
Yeah.
Although I think this is...
I think
is
they call it a requel.
A requel, is that
what
it's
they
called?
Do in the Scream
God
series.
God help us. Well, that's because it's all that knowing stuff anyway. But I think this is quite an interesting scene where she... Although she maybe isn't in love with Larry anymore, she doesn't want him to be killed either. So even she is... scared of Frank at this point.
Well, she has some limits. Yeah. Although I think... technically, Frank is the worst person in this film, right?
He's totally psychotic.
Or indeed the worst person in any film.
And he has no soul at all. I mean, but it seems to me that even when he was human, he wasn't a very nice guy.
No, And in fact, the first thing he does when he's sort of reformed back and fully back to life is... kill the woman who did it for him.
Yeah, and then go after his niece.
Yeah.
Which is not pleasant.
Yeah.
It's not what people should do. I mean, he is a deeply unpleasant person in this, which is why I think Hellraiser 2 works so well, because it inverts this plot in a very clever way. And we'll talk about it more on Hellraiser 2 and how Peter Atkins sort of took this and went, well, okay, we're change this up a bit.
So is that the one key off in... in Chinatown?
No, I think this again is the local Chinese restaurant in Cricklewood. I don't think we moved very far from Dulles Hill or Cricklewood for this. As I say, I didn't move very far from North London. It was easy to get to, easy to get home in the evenings. I wish all the films I worked on had been this easy to get to be honest. But again, you know, these were local. And the nice thing was we put quite a lot of money into the local community around there as well, because, you know, these people get paid to close their restaurant down, and you know, you'll see it in the other films as we go on to Hellraiser 3. You know, these are extras. Sometimes, you know, we're using, you know, people who are around. And again, it's all to do with pacing. Nowadays, you wouldn't have a scene like this in one of these movies. It would be, let's go on to the next horror thing. Let's go on to the next exciting thing. Whereas Clive understands pacing. He understands performance. He understands plot. So you need those quiet periods between the hammer killings and the skinned corpses and everything else. And as I say, I love the writing on this movie. I mean, you know, it's so tight, it's so good. And by the time we get to number three victim here, who's
Michael
a guy
Cassidy.
Called, yeah, Michael Cassidy, who actually became a stuntman and a stunt coordinator. Unbelievable. But as the third victim...
Well, yeah, he's on the abyss.
Suddenly... Yeah. Things have changed, and this is my favourite scene in this film. And I was standing there when she looks around, and that smile disappears off her mouth, and you understand now she has become the monster. Mm. She has now been so dehumanised and desensitised that she is now the one to be worried about, not Frank. She is the strong woman is now taking control, and that look that Claire Higgins did, which again I think was totally. If it wasn't made up, it's certainly Clive and she made it up on the spot. It was so clever. And I'm standing literally a few feet away, and it scared the hell out of me when I saw it. And I think it's one of the great scenes in this film. But yeah, and now you've got the third victim who actually is an innocent. He's kind of shy. He's kind of nervous. He doesn't quite understand. He's out of his depth. The other two weren't out of their depth. Mm. But this guy is out of his depth. And you actually start to feel sorry for him. And this is when it starts to become a horror movie, a real horror movie. And she enjoys that. She enjoyed that blow. And she wants to just keep going now. And the house itself looks good. I mean, it does look like the proverbial haunted house.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it all adds to the look and the feel of this being what it is, which I still think is, you know, is a classic British horror movie of the 80s. And I think it remains that to this day. This bit I thought was kind of interesting, where he sticks his fingers into and it's sort of like almost like a vampire sucks the essence out through the fingers. It's never really explained in this or the second one what that's all about, but it's just, again, you know, Clive came up with all this stuff in his fiction. Of course he came up with it in his script. It's just quirky and weird.
Yeah, and I think maybe one of the issues with there now being a whole bunch of sequels to it is too much has been explained. In fact, I think quite a lot of the Hellraiser films contradict each other in terms of how the puzzle boxes work. They stop being Cenobites after a while and become just demons, although I think they're back to being Cenobites. Technically, a Cenobite is a monk who lives in a cell. I think basically it's a word that Clive liked the sound of.
Yes, it's a nice word. I mean, I think it came to mean... I think at one point a sort of what would you call it, a warden of hell, if you think of it that way. Yeah. So they are basically they're like the people who are meant to stop you from escaping. Of course, Frank escapes, which is what his punishment is going to be at some point in this. But so they're like the soldiers of hell. I think is how. But you're absolutely right. Cenobite actually is a real word. It wasn't actually made up for this film. Although it'd be interesting, I've never looked it up in the dictionary. Maybe it now says, you know, guy with pins in his head or something. Right, I mean, who knows? Because the lovely thing about languages, you and I know, is it changes over the years.
Yeah.
And it can be used in different ways. And again, I think that's a pretty cool scene as well. Mm. I mean, you know, if you're talking about shocks, and you know, it's a proper horror film.
We're an hour into this film, and the heroine has only just realised she's in a horror film.
Yeah. And we've seen some pretty bizarre stuff. Mm. And again, if you I mean, what were we? We were in our 20s, I guess, in those days or whatever.
Well, I was.
Yeah, and I was. And you know, I don't think I'd ever seen anything like this in British cinema. At that time, even British horror cinema, and you and I were already reviewing for magazines and stuff at that point.
I mean, now that you can see this in the context of the 80s. If you watch this and say Extro back to back, you can see there are things that link them. There are attitudes and styles, and even and particularly actually its effects techniques.
Yes, well, the effects technique and Extro are quite similar.
Yeah, this, actually, and I suppose and Extro is also it. There, it's the father of the family who's taken over by a gooey alien, yep, and does gruesome stuff to various people around, and that also has weird surreal things.
Well, that was actually filmed around the corner from where my parents used to live, yeah, when I was living with them. Yeah. So it was the first film set I ever went down on Extro, and I did a report with photographs for Famous Monsters of Filmland, for the last issue of Famous Monsters of Filmland.
Yeah, the magazine you killed.
Well, technically, I was in the last issue. But I actually took... They didn't have any publicists or photographers, yeah, so I actually took the stills that used in the magazine on my own camera, my own little brownie camera. Whereas, again, you know, we took hundreds and hundreds of colour transparencies and black and white photographs. I shot about 4 hours of video footage behind the scenes on this, none of which I've really seen. I mean, I think the EPK runs for about 12 minutes maximum. So there's hours of behind the scenes video footage and interviews which are sitting in a vault somewhere. I once went down to the vault at New World Pictures in Los Angeles and saw them. But of course, when they got sold, I guess all this stuff got sold onto another company and to another company. And it's never... It's never come back in. Again, there's no reason for two nuns to be walking down the street. I think Clive just thought that would be a cool image.
Yeah, are they actual nuns?
Or... No, I think they are actually actresses dressed as nuns.
No, I was thinking... are they like guys in drag as nuns?
Oh, they might be. Is that, do you remember that? I might remember that, actually. Yeah, you might be right.
I know that the first time I met Pete Atkins on the set of Nightbreed, he was in drag.
On Nightbreed, yeah, he was.
That may well be a Clive Barker thing. And here is somebody with a New York hat to prove
very
that
very confusing. Not a lot of people in Crooklyn wear New York hats, but there we are. Mm. And this I thought was interesting because this actually crops up again in the second film as well. The flowers, the opening petals.
Yeah, it's a nice little bit of imagery.
And, of course, it also reflects the lament configuration box as well, the way that opens up. And of course, it doesn't really open up. Yeah. There's multiple versions of that box, each of which does one different thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes it will open and the next one will open and twist. And the next one will open, twist, and do something else. So, yeah, each of them, you know, does a different little thing. Now, it's kind of interesting how this was put together because, I mean, God knows, image animation under Bob Keane and Jeff Portas didn't have a lot of money to spend. And so they had to come up with all different ways to pump blood through tubes off camera. And they do that for the mattress and the dream sequence. Or when you see the blood going into the floor of the attic, it was all reverse photography and things like that. It was just inventive ways, which I think filmmaking always gives you. You have to come up with inventive ways to do it. Whereas, you know, as you say, if you're Tony Scott or something, you can just do anything. Just, you know, if you need an aeroplane, you get an aeroplane. If you need a helicopter, you get a helicopter. We didn't have that kind of budget, and like the old Hammer films in many ways, you know, you had to do the best you could with what you had. But again, would an American hospital ward look like this?
No, it's so
like insane.
It,
asylum. I mean,
that was Raoul Neuny and Sharon Bauer playing the doctor.
Yeah,
and nurse.
I don't really know. I never met them, so.
Sharon Bauer was in the famous Nicholas Nickleby production.
Oh, the BBC one?
I think it was the National Theatre originally, but it was then the BBC, and that was kind of a big thing. But she had several roles in that.
Theatrical background.
Raoul Neuny had been in Richard Lester's Cuba, but didn't do that much work.
Right.
And
again, remember, there's no CGI at this point.
Yeah.
So this is actual animation on screen.
Yeah, it's one of the things that marks this out as a film made the year it's made, isn't it? The
and Hellbound.
They are sort of a bit Disco Roadshow.
I mean, they're probably drawn onto the negative or something.
Yeah, and that definitely is. Yes.
And you see it even more in Hellbound with the Leviathan stuff, where we'll talk about on that. Because, yeah, they are basically film opticals. They are they are not what CGI... Of course, nowadays you could do... I mean, I don't know how well it was done in Hellraiser 2022. Mm. But and again, this is all physical effects. Mm. You know, those walls really pulled apart. And hell was really behind it. No, that was it. Basically, we built a bit of the tunnel, and then the rest of it was a canvas painting of the tunnel going off into infinity, like you would see in a hall of mirrors, let's say. So there was a physical tunnel which we needed for the effects that will come up later, and then you can see there, and then the rest of it is just basically a canvas hanging at the back of a wall. But the way it's lit, the way Robin Vigen lit it, the way Dickie Marden edited it, the way Clive set it up, it works. I mean, I think there are some things in Hellraiser that don't work as well as they should. But for the most part, looking back on it now, I think, yeah, you know what? It's not bad. It's a long time ago for all of us.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly pleased to be involved, to have been involved, even in a very small way, in a very small way I was. And even, we know, you know, a lot of the actors are still on the circuit and in doing, you know, reunions and signing things and whatever.
There's something that must have been for them a 2 or 3 week gig.
But it was the iconic imagery. Yeah. Now, you know, the engineer, which is another denizen of hell.
Yeah.
Big thing on you know, it's going to be the big monster of the movie. This is this is the alien,
but literally,
or the predator.
Nobody remembers it, right?
And it's on a wheelie cart, which if you look closer, you'll freeze frame.
Yeah.
You can actually see at the bottom there. It's like on a trolley,
yeah.
And it was pushed very fast.
It's a scary wheelbarrow.
It's basically a scary wheelbarrow, with animatronic bits being worked off set electronically. Yeah. Again, you would do that in CGI now. That would all be CGI now, and it'd look fantastic. But that's a physical effect. And so she has to run up and down this tunnel about 8 or 9 times. Mm-hmm. And we have to push that thing up and down, and the hands move, and the face moves, and the legs move, because there's about 5 guys twiddling knobs on radio control devices off of it. And that's an example of how things have improved and how CGI would have improved this film.
Although I like physical effects, I think the thing... The CGI effects can sometimes look really impressive, but what you don't get is the invisible thing that I think Ashley Lawrence is giving a better performance because there are 5 guys chasing her with a wheelbarrow loaded with monsters.
Oh, absolutely. If you know those Ray Harryhausen films, to react to something that's not there is much harder than to react to something that is actually, and that was like, you know, 8-9 feet high, that thing. Yeah. I mean, it was a big prop.
Yeah.
God, if it ever happened to it, I must say. I wonder where the engineer is now. Yeah. I know quite understand why he's called the engineer as well. I guess Clive, because Clive wrote little background stories to all of that.
Yeah, and you published some of them.
I published some of them. I'm sure it's probably in there.
Yeah, you should read your own book.
I should go back and read the Hellraiser Chronicles at some point. But he had little, and again, I think it's a theatrical thing where for your character, you want some background to give to the performance.
Yeah.
You want to know why. And again, you know, we get the characters coming back now. So here's Nicholas Vince as Chatterer. And then Nick went on to do other things, including becoming a very respected comics writer.
Yeah, and he's done quite a lot of... He's probably done more work as an actor in recent years.
Yes, he's come back. As a Simon Banford, as Butterball there.
Yeah.
Butterball,
and the thing is, of course... neither of them are recognisable from this, but Doug Bradley is. Therefore,
he picked the right role.
He picked the right role.
His voice is fabulous.
Yeah.
God, and they were thinking of dubbing him into American. Trust me. And thank God they kept him, because that voice. It's not so much the look as well. I mean, obviously the look is 100%.
Yeah,
but the voice is what, because it's basically Shakespearean dialogue, and Pete Atkins kept it going. The female Cenobite is played by Grace Kirby,
who never came back.
She was actually Clive's cousin.
Oh, right.
And she went on to actually become a drama teacher in Cumbria, and I think she's actually very striking in this as the female Cenobite. And you know, she has a few lines of dialogue in this, and they are good. I mean, because you see, again, you've got to remember at this point, Pinhead is not actually technically the leader of anybody. In fact, he's not even called Pinhead.
He's not.
He's basically lead Cenobite,
At this time, Pinhead was one of the dolls in the Puppet Master series.
Oh, from Empire, Pinhead.
So there are two Pinhead franchise fiends. I don't know who first called...
We'll see in the later things. You'll see when he's first called Pinhead.
I don't know who outside the films first called him Pinhead. Apart from anything else, those aren't pins, they're nails.
They're nails, so he should be called Nailhead.
Nailhead, yeah. And Nailhead is a pun as well, so Clive would have liked that.
I think what happened was Bob Keane and Jeff Portas and their crew in the makeup department called him Pinhead as a sort of nickname, as a joke.
Yeah, that's because I think Doug was being a bit irritating, wasn't he? I mean, it's like...
Oh, I don't think that was true. I've never heard that story.
I'd say everybody who's ever worked with Doug says, what a great guy.
He put up with a lot.
Because that's
not a mask. That's prosthetics.
Yeah.
So they have to build it up piece by piece. Like the old days with Karloff and Jack Pierce.
Yeah.
It hadn't really changed. They had to stick bits of foam to his face and then hide the lines and then paint it all, and then of course taking it off took 3 hours or 2 hours in the evenings.
I've worked with actors who've gone through that.
I mean, later on in the Hellraiser films they did refine the makeup process a little bit more, and then for some of the even later ones, the ones that none of us were involved with, I think it is kind of like a mask and you know, a pullover mask and things like that.
It's also techniques
And it's changed.
And they start using reusable versions because it's cheaper.
As you know, some of the stuff that they used back in the old Universal days used to burn the skin when they took it off and ripped the skin off.
Yeah. Elsa Lanchester hated Jack Pierce for the rest of her life for one day's work on Bride of Frankenstein. You know, it's like...
And I know certainly for people like Nick and Simon and those guys, they were over-the-head masks and then they had to, like, you know, match the lines around the eyes and things like that. But obviously, I guess for Grace Kirby and for Doug, they really had to sit down and have this stuff very carefully taken off, because it would involve all sorts of sticking things on brushes.
Everybody else was down the pub.
You know what? Actually was true because there actually was a pub just across the road from the production offices. And very much so true on the next film, which we shot at Pinewood Studios. So we would all be down the pub while they were still in makeup, having their makeup taken off. I don't think Doug ever actually let us off for that. Because he was a bit sad.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and again, this is something else I'd not really encountered before, having been a journalist on the film set and maybe gone down for 1 or 2 days. Yeah. It was like a family. Mm. You lived together, you worked together, you slept together. You ate together and you worked together. And for sometimes, for very long periods of time, I guess there was some sleeping together as well, in some cases. Yeah. Some of the later films.
You may not want to bring all of those, put any of that onto the public record.
But I mean, because you are basically for 3 months, you're just a family having to hang out together.
Yeah. Except, of course, nobody knew Nick and Simon.
There is a story that at the end, I think it was in Camden Town, we had the rap party. And there's a story that basically, certainly of Doug Bradley, and I think it is also true probably of Nick and Simon, that nobody recognised them because nobody had actually seen them out of makeup on the set. Well, of course, that's not true. I had, because I had to interview them. Bob Keane and Jeff Portas had, and all the makeup crew had. So we knew exactly who they were when they came in. And because I was actually on the door of the rap party... Because I was actually, again, when you're a unit publicist, you have to do a lot of different things. And so I had to help with all the publicity. Although, at the end of the day, all the publicity had to go through a company called Dennis Davison Associates, which I knew you worked with as well. Yeah. And a very nice guy there called Jonathan Rutter, who was
he's still in the business.
Yeah, but he was also one of those guys, as you know, Kim, who loved horror films.
Yeah.
He was one of us. And so they were the conduit to New World Pictures, because they handled all New World's pictures in the UK. And I think in Europe as well. So all the work I did, and then had to go to Jonathan, and then from Jonathan it would go to New World. So I was actually the person who had to gather it all together and put it together, and then it would go to them, and then they would send it all to New World, and then the New World publicist would create the marketing campaign. But that would be for 6, 7, 8 months. And of course, by then we wanted stuff to be in the magazines, Fangoria, Starburst, Ciné Fantastique, all those kind of magazines. We wanted them to already be running stories. They already have photos and to whet people's appetites. And that's why I still think today Hellraiser was such a huge success, because by the time it came out, everyone in the genre was looking forward to it because they'd already seen, they'd had tasters of it. They'd read little, you know, little reviews or interviews with people thinking, "Ooh, I remember that film from 6 months ago in, you know, in Starburst. Oh, the interview with Clive Barker. Yeah, I'm going to see that when it comes out." Whereas, of course, what used to happen was the film would come out, there'd be a press junket for a day, and then it'd be out for 3 weeks, and then it would disappear, and then turn up on TV 3 years, so 6 years later.
I say, I think I was on set for Sight and Sound.
Were your City Limits?
And City Limits.
Yeah, City Limits.
I did pieces for both of them. But you must have had, like, Phil Nutman from Fangoria.
Yep.
Alan Jones,
all those guys. Yeah. The most interesting one is on the EPK. Now, the EPK electronic press kit, because I was a video director, we shot not only behind-the-scenes stuff, but we shot two camera interviews with the cast and crew, which could then be cut up to use on talk shows or whatever. But there was a young journalist who came down who wanted more experience working with video and said, "Steve, would you mind if I did the interviews?" Because normally I would do the interview. I'd sit in the chair with a camera behind me over my shoulder, and they would just cut me out and do the interviews, you know, get the answers from the actors. And I said, no, that's fine. And that was Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
And so Neil did all the interviews on the EPK, and then we cut him out.
Yeah. I think he sold the interviews to Nave magazine, the porn magazine we were working for at the time.
Well, that was the lovely thing was, I knew all you guys from the press junkets, the press screenings and everything else. And also the American guys. So, you know, and the Europeans. I remember the French were really hot for the Hellraiser movies. L'Écran Fantastique, I think it was called.
Alan Shlokoff.
Yeah, and those guys. Alan Shlokoff and those guys. And they would come over and you know, because it was just come over on the ferry or the train or whatever they had in those days. And
it was the train, the ferry, they didn't have
They had no train, did they? It was just the ferry in those days or flyover or something. Yeah. So, but then again, I think this is kind of interesting. You know, that Andy Robinson now gives a very different kind of performance.
And this is why Andy Robinson has been cast, is for this scene.
For this last, whatever it is, last 20 minutes of the movie, he is now Frank in skin.
Yeah.
And he's crazy. I mean, he's already been crazy, but now he's like the human face of crazy.
Is he his voice dubbing?
I think it's him personally.
Dubbing Sean Chapman.
I don't know. Actually, you know what? I don't think like so because it doesn't sound like him. No, I don't think so. I don't know who did any of the dubbing.
But he is doing Frank now.
Yeah, it's his performance. Oh, definitely.
I mean,
him.
You wouldn't dub him.
No. Yeah. No, why would you?
Why would they dub such a performance?
I think that's one of the nice things about this film is that suddenly. And again, it's all what I was saying earlier about pacing. You know, this was always this paced like this towards the end. And so that's why they needed those earlier scenes of Frank coming back, just to give those earlier scenes a bit more of a lift. And that's unfortunate, of course.
Yeah, but he doesn't seem that upset that the woman who's done all these terrible things in order to bring him back to life, he's just semi-accidentally killed.
So I'm going to suck your soul out anyway, then, and suck your life force out as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, again, it's a very interesting plot. It's thought out. It's scripted. It's not just, you know, random mayhem of teenagers being chopped up, which is, of course, what most horror films were in the late 80s.
I remember, actually, in the chat I had with Clive before he made it, he did say that he was aware that what was expected of horror films was random teenagers being chopped up. And he said, "No, we're getting the finest British actors and chopping them up."
And I think that's true. And I honestly believe that back in that day, New World had no idea what to make of this. When they were seeing rushes coming back every couple of days, because again, you know, there was no computers in those days, so they probably had to be put in a can and flown to Los Angeles or freighted to Los Angeles. And they're looking at this stuff going, what the hell are those Brits doing? And I know that's why Tony Randall got involved, because Tony had already worked for Roger Corman. He already made at least one film, I think. He used to cut trailers for Roger Corman. So he knew all about pacing. He knew about that kind of stuff. And so Tony, towards the end of this film, I think he even flew over, was very hands-on in what it was they expected. But to be fair, he also understood Clive's vision for this film, so he didn't interfere in the way that you sometimes hear about. I mean, especially Nightbreed is a great example of that, where basically they just interfered all the time, and Hellraiser 4, which I wasn't on. But at this point, no, Tony Randall is a good filmmaker in his own right and a good scriptwriter in his own right, and he understood what, once he got here and understood what was going on, it was like, oh, okay, yeah, I understand this now. All right, I'm going to let you guys get on with this and let you know, because, you know, we've got something special here. And as you said earlier, very unlike House.
Yeah.
You know,
which is probably what, if not what they expected, was what was the default horror film of the mid-80s.
Yeah, it was a fun, jokey...
I like House. I think it's it's a solid, entertaining picture, and I will happily watch it. Yeah, that's pushing it.
House 3.
House 2 does have that scene with John Ratzenberger, which I think is one of the best scenes in any...
Wasn't it because they had the other guy, first House,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right, George Wendt. But the John Ratzenberger scene in House 2, the second story, is a little masterpiece. It's a shame the rest of the film isn't up to it. But that was what New World could have expected. I mean, obviously, they must have read the script and knew this was I remember Neil actually saying that he read the Hellraiser script well before, and he said the thing it reminded him of was Blood Simple, the Coen brothers' first film. And I sort of see that. And I wonder if Neil had read a version which had less, like, magic in it than...
Well, I mean, I tell you, and this is something that people don't quite understand about movies, and I think it's worth pointing out, that no movie comes out in the same way it was shot. You shoot extra material, alternate scenes are used, some scenes never make it into the final film. And with a script, and again, this is something I discovered, because I had a copy of the script, I still have my Hellraiser script, but I also have all the pink pages, because every day you got another set of pink or blue or green pages of updates and changes and rewrites and whatever. So whatever way the script starts is never the way the script ends. And it's chock-a-block full with different colour pages and upgrades and updates and things like that. So when people, and I see a lot of stuff online now and in the magazine saying, well, I was down there and they shot this scene with the Cenobites, it's not in the final film because somebody cut it out. It's like, no, it probably never was in the final film. It never made the final cut, because the film probably contractually had to come in at 94 or 95 minutes or something like that. That was the deal.
I think this is exactly 90 minutes, isn't it?
I think I've got 94 minutes is actually what this one is. And all of them come in at around that time.
It was probably 90 minutes on UK video.
It was running
at a slightly different time, but
With different runs, slightly different running times and things like that. And of course, one of the things this did introduce was the whole S&M thing with the chains. And I've got to say, credit to Jane Wildgoose, who was the woman who created the costumes on these, because she was like, you know, we looked at punks. You remember punks in the
80s? Yeah.
But remember, punks really came in the early 90s as well, punk music and things. But she was looking at what the kids were wearing in Carnaby Street, the chains, the hooks, the piercings. And Clive knew that stuff as well. I mean, Clive, I don't think he was into it, but he certainly knew it. And so they incorporated that into the movie before anybody else did, to be honest, as far as I can tell, as a way of really talking to that generation.
It's one of the things in Hellraiser Inferno, Scott Derrickson's film. There's a scene where the cop actually says, oh, we should start looking for suspects among the body piercing community. And that's the first acknowledgement in the series that such a thing exists outside of the film.
I know Clive went went to sort of, I think, S&M clubs in New York and Amsterdam for that kind of thing.
Apparently he did a lot of research.
I know there was things with African fetish sculptures and things like that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff feeding into this at the time.
I remember we were once going around the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and we walked into a room, and we thought it's a Hellraiser exhibit. It's all the no, it wasn't. It was just the room that Clive had walked into.
Probably walked through
in the past.
Yeah, made some notes or whatever. Yeah. Um, And again, you know, this is an iconic scene. Mm. The whole Jesus wept thing at the mm-hmm. end. I mean, there was a bad word in there which we weren't allowed to use. But the tongue thing. I mean, yeah. You know, the pleasure and pain thing, and that all, I think, sometimes gets blown a little out of proportion in the sequels and the follow-ups. Mm. Whereas in this, you know, and that's cut as well. But that was cut beforehand. Mm. I mean, there was more of it in the version I saw. Mm. Straight after filming, and I guess it got snipped back and snipped back and mm-hmm. snipped back. But there's really quite a lot of exploding heads in this. But I guess that's coming out of the whole David Cronenberg.
Yeah,
things.
I wonder if it was cut for censorship reasons or because we'd seen that effect too many
times. I think
times,
the latter.
And it's like it's not. I'm sure it was good, but it probably wasn't as good as John Cassavetes exploding at the end of Brian De Palma's The Fury, which is like the best exploding person ever.
Exactly. Yeah. But here's something. Yeah. This is quite interesting because you've got it. You realise now that although this is Julia on the bed, if people haven't quite realised yet. So either she made it to the bed laid down, or the Cenobites put her on the bed and then put the chains in her. And then you start to realise, oh, wait a minute, the box caused the Cenobites, but there's something else going on. I think that's a beautiful shot. I mean, I think that is one of the, again, a great, great shot.
Yeah. We'll talk more about Doug Bradley's ascendancy throughout this series from bit part to above the title billing.
Yeah, and it's true. In the first three films, he makes that journey, very much so.
From afterthought to star. But this is his star-making scene, isn't it? It's like,
well, this whole ending is as well. But again, you know, they're gotten rid of quite quickly with the optical effects. Yeah. It's quite, you know, oh, and now they're gone. Mm. And I was standing here. This is giant lumps of polystyrene being rained down on us. Because, of course, we couldn't ruin the house because it was somebody's house which we had to give back them at the end of the shoot. Yes. So what we did, we had powdered polystyrene. You know those polystyrene blocks they used to put in ceilings and things? Probably cancerous or something now, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's...
But there's basically polystyrene coming down. You can actually see some of it if you slow it down.
Yeah.
Just to make it like the ceiling was falling down.
Let's just hope that Ashley Lawrence doesn't now turn around and sue Clive for pouring polystyrene on him.
I think polystyrene's all right. I think
all
these other
years
things
ago,
you've got to worry about.
Well,
I guess you still get, you know, popcorn lung or something, can't you, from that? But yeah, I mean, you know, I love the fact that, you know, it's ending up, it's kind of like what Halloween did, the ending after ending after ending thing.
Yeah.
I mean, this poor girl, she thinks she's free and then something else happens. She thinks she's free and then something else happens.
Yeah. Although it's presumably, she hasn't done anything that's worthy of punishment.
No, but she called them, and the rule, and as you say, the rules change over in the various films. But the deal always was: you call us, we take you back, and then it kind of got tweaked slightly so that, and you'll see that in the next film, only people who deserve to be taken back get taken back, and then it's just they just kill anybody. I think by number four, or five, or six, or whatever.
It's because nobody's died in a couple of minutes, and this film
we need just kills off some more annoying teenagers.
Yeah.
Whatever.
The series does in fact turn into the kind of film that Clive explicitly didn't want to make.
Yes, but by then he's not involved anymore. Yeah. Pete Atkins is not involved anymore. Yeah. Bob Keane's not involved anymore. Yeah. But as I say, you know, even one last shock with the engineer here, I just think, okay, guys, right, we're done now, aren't we? Yeah. That's it, we're all sorted. But this is quite good because, you know, basically it's to do with the box and getting the box back and all this kind of thing.
So it's nice, though, that you can defeat the minions of hell with an empty milk bottle.
Yeah. We can certainly hold them at bay for a couple
and
of
I've
seconds.
And I have to say, that's a British milk bottle.
Yes,
it's really British, isn't it? It's like so many things in this film are just everyday objects that you do not get in America.
Well, I say, to me, and we'll see it again, even worse in Hellbound Hellraiser 2, Some places don't look like America. Oh, look, there's that fireplace, I think I was talking about. Oh, no, that's the stairs. Yeah. But, yeah, you see how the engineer, again, is meant to be like one of the Cenobites. He's a sort of major-ish character, which, again, they sent back to hell with some cheap optical effects.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they was cheap.
They probably weren't back then.
They were 1986 optical effects. They are... probably the single aspect outside of maybe the hairstyles that has most dated.
But do you find the film? I don't find the film dated.
I don't.
It's of its time. I agree.
I think that the opticals are technically dated. I actually don't. I think the hairstyles and the clothes or whatever. Hey, it's a film that's made and set in 1986.
Well, I've got to say, I think Ashley Lawrence's hair is fantastic throughout this whole film.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And that's her real hair. She's not wearing a wig or extension, so that's her real hair.
Yeah.
Not sure about his. I'm not sure whether Robert Hines really had that curly
hair. Yeah, I suspect more work has been done on that hair than on Pinhead's head, you know. But
I mean, I think one of the great refreshing things about this film is it still stands up. Well, this is why I don't understand why they wanted to make a new version for 2022 and change things up.
It was
I guess,
a requel rather than a remake. I think this would be a difficult film to actually remake.
But I've always thought, why bother remaking?
It's like they've recast Pinhead a couple of times, and I think
that's a mistake. If you want my opinion,
I do too. Because hey, he's still alive; he can still do the voice.
And that's why you know, even if you want to recast him physically, let Doug dub them. Let Doug dub the voicing because it's his voice. But this is an interesting because this was an add-on.
I think it would be hard to recast Claire Higgins. I think there are plenty of actresses who could play equivalent roles, but somehow Julia is Claire Higgins in a way that would be difficult to get round.
But this is another scene that was added by the Americans at the end of the film, which is like, okay, what?
But at the time, I remember talking to Wes Craven about the very end of A Nightmare on Elm Street, and he said the New Line just came to him and said, look, you've got to give us a hook for the sequel.
That's the pulling the girl through the window.
That's right. Thing, and this is it, isn't it? This is the hook for Hellraiser 2.
Yes.
And actually, I think because probably the demand came earlier in the day, don't think this is a particularly bad sequel.
No, and the thing is that you've got to remember that Hellraiser 2 was green-lighted before Hellraiser 1 had ever come out and never been released. Yeah. And it's actually quite a neat scene. This is not the ruins of the house, by the way. This is just wasteland in London. Well, it's supposed to be somewhere, but in London. But this whole thing, you know, with him turning into a fossil
is
demon.
Weird. I always forget that has this. It's not a Ray Harryhausen type demon because it's a big puppet, isn't it? But
But are they in hell? Are they already in hell? Yeah. I don't know. I just don't know.
Well,
it's like, who knows? But I love this idea. This I thought was terrific, where the box returns to somewhere and is sold again. This was always
and
it's very cool.
For instance, they could easily have done a sequel which didn't bring back any of the characters from the previous films and was just about the next idiot.
I think that was that was part of the thinking about it, and you will see in some of these other films. I love the size of these titles as well, because my name is really big later on. People don't do. Why don't people do credits like this anymore? Why are they so small you can't read them?
On streaming services, they're cut off with adverts for things.
Oh, for the next thing. Yeah.
And apparently, Anthony Allen's name is misspelled.
Oh yeah. Luckily, I didn't do the credits on this one. Yeah. I ended up doing the credits on some. But look how far down Doug Bradley and all the rest of their names are. They are way down.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was an interesting. I thought it was an interesting movie. Mm-hmm. I certainly had a great time on it. I mean, it was a huge amount of fun for me. And everybody could not have been nicer. I've got to say, it was one of those films that I still look back on with fondness. Mm-hmm. And seeing it again after, God, how many years is it now? I mean, God, it's a long time. It still stands up well. I think, you know, if you've never seen Hellraiser before, yeah, I think you could be quite impressed with that. I mean, so I think some kids will go, seen it all before now.
Yeah.
saw that on the Disney Plus channel last week.
Yeah.
But for me, it was an iconic movie at the time. It certainly changed the way we did
there
horror
are,
films.
Unit publicist?
Yeah, not Stephen Jones. They spelt my name wrong. They spelt my name wrong as well.
Yeah, right. Oh,
As I say, I didn't do the credits. Of course, I was known as Steve on set all the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was my name, and on the next one, it's Steve as well, because I knew the credits on that either. And in fact, we should talk about Christopher Young's music, which you know, it wasn't meant to be on there. Clive had his own idea about who he wanted.
It was Coil, Steve.
It was
Throws
Coil, yeah. So I heard the music.
And that has been released on Friday.
They did a score, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. And it's a terrific score, but probably Christopher Young was the right
call. Oh, Christopher Young's score makes this film, and again, is used throughout the sequels as well.
Oh, well, we'll
And a good tight crew. And we talk more about those guys, you know, on some of the
because,
other.
Because, frankly, we're coming back for the next two films. So there's a lot more of Steve Jones's anecdotes of life on set. There's a peep behind the scenes on some of the the wilder, stranger elements.
Yeah, well, the next two films, number two and number three, were more crazy than number one, I gotta say. They got progressively crazier as we worked on them.
Yeah. It's a good thing that this isn't a 10-disc box set taking you through the whole saga because
we'd have to get some other people.
Things get really, really strange.
But yeah, so stay tuned for the next Steve Jones, My Life in Hell.
Yeah. We will be back.